Yeah. I'm going to ask everybody to take their seats. We're going to go ahead and get this meeting going. First of all, for those who I haven't met, I'm Aubrey Lane, the Secretary of Transportation, and I had the pleasure of calling this committee together on July 17th at the last Commonwealth Transportation Board. So, first of all, I want to thank all the members who graciously volunteered or otherwise were asked to be here today to represent this new public-private partnership committee. Probably be wise if we first of all had you all introduce yourselves. Maybe we'll start over here with the left, Mr. Fralin.
Okay, we push the mic to talk. How's this work? Mics are hot? Okay. Make sure you tell me that when I come in the room.
My name is William Fralin. I am a former member of the House of Delegates and a member of the Commonwealth Transportation Board, and I'm happy to be here. I don't know what else to say.
I'm Scott Kasperwitz, Commonwealth Transportation Board, Urban At-Large Member, also pleased to be here.
I'm Betsy Daly. I'm the Staff Director for the Virginia Senate Finance Committee.
Nick Donahue, Deputy Secretary of Transportation.
Robert Vaughn, I'm the Staff Director for the House Appropriations Committee of the Virginia House of Delegates.
I'm Janet Ayler. I'm the Director of Debt Management at the Virginia Department of Treasury and former Deputy Secretary of Finance.
Hi, I'm Steve Pittard. I'm the Chief Financial Officer with the Department of Rail and Public Transportation.
So thank you again all. You're here by your actual job title or as required by House Bill 1886, all represented. And so glad to see all of you could make it today. I have basically two functions before I turn this over to you. One is I want to give a quick overview of for you to have some background of how the McAuliffe administration views the new laws, also what we expect will be coming from you. And then one housekeeping, we need to elect a chairman so that when I exit the podium, I can actually turn this meeting over to somebody. So what I thought I would do first is really just go through a few things about P3s, public-private partnerships, and how Governor McAuliffe and his administration will view this process. First of all, let me be right up front. I don't think there could probably be any other pro-business governor or Secretary of Transportation than myself and Governor McAuliffe. So we very much value and realize that public-private partnerships are a great procurement tool that can benefit taxpayers. And in fact, for us to deliver our transportation program here in the Commonwealth, public-private partnerships are going to have to be a part of that for us to move forward. But they are not a default procurement method. All options should be considered before making decisions, and that's one of the reasons we'll go through the process we're going through today. We believe that you have to take a look at all the options and then make the best decision possible that is on behalf of the taxpayers. During this process, we believe you need to be transparent and accountable to both the public and the elected officials. Today's meeting is open to the public. It is actually being live streamed, I believe. And I would encourage all your future deliberations to be open to the public and transparent, because I believe that will get us to the right decision as we move forward on the procurement we're going to talk about in a few minutes. And of course, we want to embrace the reforms of House Bill 1886. Now, many of you are familiar with that. The three major provisions of that particular legislation, one, this committee came into being, and now if we enter a Public-Private Transportation Act procurement, it now has to have an affirmation from you before the procuring agency, whether it be VDOT or the Department of Rail or Public Transit, moves forward with that. Second of all, it guarantees that the Secretary of Transportation, along with the procuring agency, first of all, up front, the procuring agency must certify that it's in the best interest, and Mr. Kilpatrick is here to go through that today. And then I, as Secretary of Transportation, and everyone that follows me, will need to then recertify if, in fact, the procurement is used and a contract is signed, that that contract also is what was identified in the finding of public interest, so that what the things we're going to ask you to consider today are actually in the contract. Now, this is new legislation for Virginia, and we've had a lot of different consultants and all work with us on this, but it's not new to our nation or to other states that have been looking at this issue. We have spent a lot of time talking with people in Florida and Texas in terms of how they have looked at public-private partnership procurements. When I first got on the Commonwealth Transportation Board, it was always talked about Virginia and Florida and Texas as delivering these type of procurements. So we have reached out to them. They, in their own way, have dealt with this procurement as it's evolved over the years. You know, here in Virginia, it came into being in 1995. We're celebrating its 20th year. But it's evolved as we go through, and I'll take you through some of that in a few minutes. But in each of their different ways, Florida has moved to something called availability payments in a way to sort of limit its risk and get a better benefit that it believes from using the private sector. Texas, on the other hand, has done some things similar to us. They have a committee like this with a couple of different exceptions. Their committee also has local representation. And before the committee can meet in Texas, the legislature has to even vote to be considered for a public-private partnership procurement. So we don't have that here. It's the procuring agency that basically says we believe it's in our best interest and asks you to use your independent knowledge to affirm that. Now, another thing I want to take you through, as we've gone through this process, there is some misunderstandings about what a Public-Private Transportation Act procurement is. As I mentioned before, we've been using this since 1995. In fact, the author of that original legislation was Senator Stosch, who gave me my first job out of college. And I've spent a lot of time with him over the last few months talking about how that act, what was his thinking behind that, and as we move forward, and how it's been applied over the years. If you look at this graph up here on my left side, I guess your left as you're viewing it, you see the public, and on the right, see private. And in between, there's a whole lot of risk for things that can be shared. Used to be here in Virginia, all we had was one model, the public model, where we went out and we designed the road, we bid it, and we built it ourselves. That's true public model, taking all the risk and using public monies to build the project. Now, if you go all the way to the other side, compare that, what we could do is sell them. You could just sell the assets. That would be a complete private model. The government gets out of the business of dealing with infrastructure. But in between, there are a whole lot of options that are available to us. Now, as you go across from left to right, you'll see the box that's called VPPA, the Virginia Public Procurement Act. These are laws that we have on our books. You would know them as Design Bid Build and Design Build. But these are laws that are currently on the books that Department of Rail and Public Transit and VDOT use to procure infrastructure. And if you go across, you're all familiar with Design, Bid, Build. We have a project management and construction management we could pass on at risk, or Design, Build, where we basically design about 30% of the road and then pass it on. That's covered by the Virginia Procurement Act. For VDOT or DRPT to use that act, if they decide to move forward and build something under that act, they do not need your involvement. They are free to go do that. It's only when we get down under the PPTA, the Public-Private Transportation Act, that the new law under House 1886 says that you need to affirm that this is a procurement that we would like to utilize. And as you go across here, you can see there are other things that are introduced to be shared with the private sector. A design bill with alternative technical concepts. Our Attorney General has just ruled to use this. It is not covered under the design bill of the Virginia Public Procurement Act. It has to be done in a PPTA. It's one of the things that Commissioner Kilpatrick is going to talk to you about today. How do we get the private sector involved in getting the engineering and their expertise in really getting to the nut of designing this particular project. Design, build, finance, design, build, operate, and maintain, which is one of the procurement items we'll be talking about today, and then design, build, finance, operate, and maintain, which you, quite frankly, would probably recognize more as a concession. And in fact, that's been some of the confusion as I've gone through this. Many people immediately believe that a PPTA is a concession, and that is not accurate. A PPTA can be any of these things in this box, it's risk sharing, where it is in the best interest of both the Commonwealth and the private sector to enter into an agreement. So I just want to make sure you understand where the procurement laws are and how those risks can be shared, and depending on what law and what your involvement is. And this is what this graph is intended to do for some background. Now, some context to what I've just talked to you about. We do not believe there should be any predetermined outcome to this process that Mr. Kilpatrick is going to go through. In other words, when we've been out there, people have said, oh, it's going to be a public finance, it's going to be this. Quite frankly, what we're going to be asking you today is to allow us to get to that level and looking at a PPTA. Now, the PPTA laws are designed to enable the Commonwealth to transfer risk when beneficial to taxpayers. As I said before, it's not a default procurement. It was always intended, and at least it's the McAuliffe administration's intention to adhere the act this way, that we will always look at what it would cost us to do it, us being the public sector, where we take all the risk, and compare that to if we shared these risks with other private entities. I was in front of the Joint Transportation Accountability Commission just a month or so ago, and one of the questions they asked me is, you know, what's the dollar amount of if we share this risk or certain risks with the private sector? And I said, I don't know, but that's the process we're getting ready to enter. The only way I do know is to go to them and ask them so that we can come back and say, and to you, this is why we chose to go this route, because we have made a value judgment that it is worth us transferring this risk. It's always, a PPTA should always be compared to a base model with the public sector doing it. So that's the way that we will be looking at you for guidance. Now, there are some other, you can call them risks, or there are some other attributes of a PPTA that you should be aware of. The commissioner, not the Commonwealth Transportation Board, will approve this final contract. Under the Virginia Public Procurement Act, the Commonwealth Transportation Board approves that contract. Here, it will be the commissioner of the procuring agency, obviously with a lot of oversight and direction from the secretary's office and the executive branch. But that's a key difference that we need to understand. Now, the CTB must approve the allocation of funds for the project, and in fact, they also have to approve a procurement, which I'll be asking them to do in September. Ask them to say that these are the benefits for a P3, just like I'm asking you. But I wanted to point out, at the end of the day, they don't get to approve the contract. So that is a difference than under the Public Procurement Act. Now, one thing that is a new safeguard is that once that contract is signed, and quite frankly, probably before that is signed, the secretary and the commissioner must certify that the finding of public interest that Mr. Kilpatrick is going to go through with you today was met before the contract is executed. So, or I have to stand up here and sign again to say what we told you we wanted to transfer, what risk we wanted to transfer, what amount it cost us, is what we executed in the contract. Now, my pledge to you is to keep you informed in that process, just like my pledge to the Commonwealth Transportation Board was, to brief them on the very details of the contract. Now, I may have to take them into private session if there's proprietary information to be released. But I will not certify this until I have the input from you and the Commonwealth Transportation Board, not your approval, but your input. Same way with the Transportation Board before I make the certification. So I want you to know that this process will be continuing as we go through, briefing you as to where we get to, should you give us the approval today or the affirmation to move forward. And I should also point out that the public option that we have looked at, and I have briefed the Commonwealth Transportation Board by using our outside consultants, that will continue to remain on the table throughout this process. and it will continue to be developed just as vigorously as the public-private Transportation Act procurement that we're going to ask you today, or Commissioner Kilpatrick today is going to ask you to affirm. So the deal, what I'm trying to impress upon you is that we're just starting the process today. We don't have all the answers. We're asking for you to affirm, or Mr. Kilpatrick will be, affirm a procurement so we can go through and look at the three risks. And broadly speaking, there are construction risk, there are operational risk, and there are financial risk, finance being both the actual financing and the traffic and revenue associated with the project. Those are the three risks that we would like to explore to be able to make an informed decision as to how we should procure or deliver this project. Deliver this project. So that's really what you'll be asked to today as we go forward. So with that, I'll quickly ask if there are any particular questions before we get into administrative and have Mr. Kilpatrick come up. But your charge today would be to affirm our ability to start looking at a P, or actually officially opening a P3 procurement to be able to make the determination what we believe is in the best interest of the taxpayer. So any of the panel have any questions of me? Are clear on your responsibilities? Okay. Then with that, I have one order of administrative business, and that is that we need to pick a chairman. And there are seven of you. So I don't know. I'll just open it up for suggestions or nominations. And
I'll nominate Deputy Secretary Donahue.
Okay, we have a nomination. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Is there any other nominations the panel would like to put forward? Hearing none, we'll close the nomination process, and all those in favor of having Mr. Donahue be the chair of your committee, please say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? Okay, thank you very much, and let me just make one final comment. I think that's good because, quite frankly, the Secretary's office will be the one during this procurement that will have the most information to share, and I think you'll be hearing it directly from our office as we move forward. And with that, thank you all for your service to the Commonwealth, and I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Chairman Donahue. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Lane. And I really want to start this afternoon's meeting by really welcoming the public and thanking the members for their attendance. This is the first meeting of the Transportation Public-Private Partnership Advisory Committee. We are going to have public comment today, but before we move into that, I just wanted to add a few additional items really clarifying to the committee as well as to the public the responsibility that this committee has today as it considers the commissioner's finding of public interest. And for members of the audience, all of the materials that were provided to the members of the committee are in the back of the room on the table, just as they are with CTB meetings. So if you'd like to, we're going to be referring to those throughout the meeting, and so if you'd like to have a copy of those, please head to the back of the room. So as the Secretary said, he impaneled this committee today to consider Commissioner Kilpatrick's finding of public interest that he executed where he believes there is public interest in procuring the I-66 outside the Beltway project as a public-private partnership. If we could all flip to the legislation that's before you, there's a few areas I want to highlight here for the committee as we take a look at this. The first is on page 3. And that's a new section of code that was added by House Bill 1886. And if it's really 33.2, 1803.2, this is the section of code that establishes this committee. And what it charges this committee with doing, or actually what it provides this committee with the authority of, is it says VDOT and DRPT may not start or initiate a procurement under the PPTA unless this committee finds and affirms the commissioner's finding of public interest that using a P3 procurement is in the public's interest. It also outlays our membership here, talks about public notice and things of that nature. This procurement would be a solicited public-private partnership, so if you flip to page 1 under 33.2.1803 and move down to subsection B, which is at the bottom of the page, there's two new requirements that VDOT and DRPT must follow to initiate a solicited public-private partnership procurement. The first is this, it must bring its finding of public interest to this committee, and it must establish a finding of public interest. The commissioner has executed that finding, and we'll hear about that today. As we talk about the finding of public interest, the requirements for that are laid out on page 3. And really, this is kind of the important part here, because it talks about what the heart of the matter that we're going to be discussing today. So really, the key part about the finding of public interest is walking through what are the risk, liabilities, and responsibilities that either are going to be assumed, assigned, or retained by the public sector, or those that the public sector is going to be transferring to the private sector to create benefits under the PPTA procurement. And so this walks through it. So I know there has been some discussion. We're not getting into the design of the I-66 out to the Beltway project. We're not talking about the number of general purpose lanes, whether or not there's hot lanes, whether or not, or what type of transit is included. Really, the discussion here this afternoon is whether or not moving forward under a P3 procurement is one that can provide value to the Commonwealth. And then the final thing that I'd like to highlight is on page 2, and Secretary Lane talked about this. Should this committee affirm the commissioner's finding of public interest, there is now a new requirement that says prior to executing any comprehensive agreement under the PPTA, in effect making any contract effective, both the commissioner and the secretary would need to certify that the risk and responsibilities that were transferred or said would be transferred under the finding of public interest were in fact transferred in the final comprehensive agreement. And so that's really a key safeguard and new accountability provision that was added by House Bill 1886 that makes sure when we start this process and we say there's benefits because we're going to transfer, say, revenue risk to that, if that's a benefit that we say is going to be realized, before we execute a contract, we need to have a contract that, in fact, transfers revenue risk to the private sector. So those are just some key provisions I wanted to highlight in the law. Are there any questions from members of the committee about House Bill 1886 or other provisions of the PPTA? Mr. Frank?
One thing, and Nick, we talked briefly about the determination this is a medium risk, the certification by the commissioner, and under the 1803.1, the finding of public interest, the responsible public entity says if the qualifying transportation facility is determined to contain a high risk, a description of how the public's interest will be protected through the transfer assignment and some sort of risk is required. And we're not doing that because it's a medium risk. And I'm just trying to figure out how that was determined. It says a second risk workshop we'll conduct in August 2015, and I'm wondering if that has taken place.
Mr. Fralin, Mr. Kilpatrick is going to walk through that during his presentation.
Okay.
There is an established process that the department, working with the Virginia Office of Public-Private Partnerships, has put in place to evaluate the project delivery risk. Again, that's not financing or other risk. It's really construction risk that exists with a project, and I expect the commissioner will walk us through that as he makes his presentation. Sorry.
So help me understand then delivery risk. Seems to me all those things were a part of delivery risk. Like if the financing falls through, you're not going to deliver. If the construction falls through, you're not going to deliver. You know.
I think those are very valid points. I think the way we would interpret and define delivery risk is, can you get a permit? Are there lots of wetlands, for example, that might be in the path of road that would be constructed? Are you within the existing footprint? Are you going outside of that footprint? Are there other issues due to the complexity of the project that might make it difficult to deliver? So are you submerging a tunnel?
Right.
Or other things of that nature.
Right. Okay.
Okay. I'd like to follow up on Mr. Fralin's question. So then what the commissioner is going to give us on risk that will meet the requirements of the second enactment of the September 1st risk assessment model?
Yes, Commissioner Kilpatrick, along with Director Kuhl, may have undertaken a risk workshop, which is the process they developed pursuant to the second enactment.
Risk workshop.
One last question on the enactment clause. I hate enactment clause. But anyway, it says the Department of Transportation should establish procurement processes and guidelines for identified high-risk projects to ensure the protection of the public interest. So if we don't make a certification of high risk, this wouldn't apply? Are these guidelines? I know we did guidelines because I helped work on them with Marty and everybody at Doug's office, but this seems to suggest a further set of guidelines for high-risk projects. But I guess this wouldn't apply since we're meeting this.
So, Mr. Fralin, this enactment clause actually was to formally codify the provision of the CTB resolution that resulted in the revision to the CTB guidelines that you and Mr. Williams worked on.
Right.
And really, at that point, it's guidelines. Any future administration could have waived them or removed them.
Sure.
And so this enactment clause was added during the legislative process to make sure that regardless of any future administration's opinion on that analysis, they would be required to undertake it. And so it's to codify that kind of moving forward.
Yeah, and I recognize that, but it says for high-risk projects.
And no, it says for the identification of high-risk projects, and so every project is required to undergo this evaluation to determine if it is of high risk.
Okay, and then, all right, gotcha. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, I have a question. It would be under number one, the description of the benefits expected to be realized by the responsible public entity through the use of this chapter compared with the development and or operation of the transportation facility through the through other options available to, in this case, I guess it would be VDOT. Is the commissioner going to walk us through, it seems to me, until you get more detail from any of the interested vendors, how do you determine that comparison?
No, Mr. Vaughn, I think that what you raise is a very relevant question, and we did struggle with this very candidly a little bit, and I think where we come down is the commissioner, in his finding of public interest, does, as the law requires, provide a written description of those benefits. What he has not provided and what he cannot provide, as you've noted, until we are further into this process, is a quantification of what those benefits might be. So really, what we're here today is not telling you exactly what the benefits of going down a P3 procurement will be. We can't say we will deliver this project 3 months faster for $25 million less and transfer X amount of revenue risk. What we can tell you is we think there may be benefits to faster construction. We think there may be benefits to transferring revenue risk. And through the procurement process in the coming months, we'll be able to quantify those benefits in more detail. Right now, we can describe and discuss what we believe they can be, but as you've noted, we cannot put a number figure in front of a lot of those until we actually go through part of the procurement process with the private parties. Now, I do want to note, as the Secretary said during his remarks, we're not going to convene this panel today and then never come back to discuss this project. It's the Secretary's intent and his commitment that we will come back to re-impanel this committee and have those discussions as we're able to start quantifying those benefits, and we really determine what, if any, of the three risks that the Secretary outlined would be transferred, and if all are to be transferred, why, and if a lesser number would be transferred, really discussion of that.
And if I could, Nick, to Robert's point, this we're really kind of a chicken and egg here, right? Because we got to certify it's in the public interest, but we don't really know what it's ultimately going to be. And I think the way I read the clause is we determine that moving forward with development is in the public interest. I think that gives me comfort because, for example, I don't know what the public's investment is going to be in this yet. I mean, obviously that affects what public interest. So the more public investment, you know, you got to weigh that. I don't know what the NVTA is going to put in this yet. That is going to impact what the assessment is going to be going forward about whether this is a good idea. So I think Robert raises a good point. I share that, but I see as our mission that we just kind of got to deal with the facts as we have them.
Well, and to Mr. Vaughn and Mr. Fralin's point, I think what I would note is really this is a dramatic change from the past. So previously there have been committees that considered whether or not moving forward with the development initiation procurement was in the public interest. That committee consisted solely of internal staff to the agency that was going to move forward there. And so I think the goals of this legislation, based on discussions we had during the session, were really to bring in a broader subset of folks, both internal, inside and outside of the procuring agency, to really require that procuring agency to have a discussion of what benefits they think they can achieve, and also, as importantly, what risk do they want to try and transfer. I think we've also had procurements in the past where we said toll risk will be transferred, operations and maintenance will be transferred, as will construction, and then after the procurement was started, that changed, and I think that caused a lot of issues for a whole host of reasons moving forward, and it's really to make sure that this discussion takes place up front. Again, we don't have all of the answers now, but I do think the commissioner and others have done due diligence, that he's going to talk about, you know, why he expects these benefits to be achieved. He didn't just write them down on paper. There have been meetings and other things that have taken place over the last 8 months that have brought us to this place.
And just to confirm, I believe the Secretary mentioned this, if this committee decides to affirm going forward with the P3, that does not preclude the public option being the final option, correct?
Yeah,
it stays on the table.
That is correct, Ms. Daly. As the Secretary noted, the department always has the authority, without coming to this committee, to move forward with any type of procurement under the Virginia Public Procurement Act. And so any action this committee takes today that would to affirm the commissioner's finding would not take that option off the table for the department should it later determine that moving forward with P3 is not in the best interest.
One final question. The Secretary had indicated, or gave me the impression in his remarks, that we would be called upon again, perhaps, as more detail is developed. And is that because he would like some input at that point as to whether or not we feel, because this is a critical piece, I mean, when you read the legislation, that comparison. And so one could construe an affirmation today is an affirmation that the P3 is what it should be, without, from at least from this group. And that may be the case. It just don't want it to come back to bite us. And some legislator says to me, well, gee, why did you agree to that when this wasn't a good benefit? So,
So what today's, if the committee were to affirm the commissioner's finding today, it would, in effect, make a statement saying this committee affirms the commissioner's finding public interest, that initiating procurement for the P3 is in the public interest. At the end of the day, the PPTA lays the responsibility for the ultimate contract squarely with the executive branch and the administration, and that will be up to the secretary and the commissioner then to ensure that as these benefits are quantified, that we have ended up with a deal that is in fact in the public's interest. I think to your point, Mr. Vaughn, about the secretary's remarks, what he intends to do then is to come back and brief this committee so that you understand how the process has evolved. I don't believe any additional action would be necessary from this committee at that time. It would be more of a workshop setting.
There's no subsequent approval or anything like that.
But we can voice concern if
you that certainly would be a venue to voice concerns if they were to arrive
or at
that
least
time.
Observations. That's because it's hard for the secretary to reaffirm whether or not any material change has been made when the first requirement, you don't have anything, you have no baseline at this point.
Well, I would take slight exception. I do think the secretary would like to hear from committee members. He's come back, but I do think there would be opportunities where something could materially change. So, again, for example, say this law had been in place previously, and I'll just use the Route 460 procurement. When that procurement was initiated, it said the Commonwealth will transfer design and construction, operations and maintenance, and financing and revenue risk. And that's how they started that procurement. And this finding would have said those are the three risks we're going to transfer. Ultimately, the contract at the end of the day did not transfer finance and revenue risk, and that would have been a materially significant change, and the secretary would not have been able to recertify that finding of public interest. So I do think we have information here that, you know, we can look at and determine whether or not it's changed moving forward. But you are right. We cannot quantify it this time and will not be able to quantify until we start procurement exactly what benefits we might realize from some of these areas the commissioner is going to talk about. Mr. Fraylin?
I'd like to give my understanding of this code section, which is just William Fraylin on the law, which doesn't mean it's the law. But my understanding of this is a body created to make decisions about whether even thinking about a P3 is what we ought to do. The actual what the law did was codify what we put in the guidelines.
Yes.
And what we put in the guidelines did not give any more say to the legislative branch than what was already there, other than this certification that we're meeting today about. And so it is a little concerning that we've got to deal with this procurement and don't know great detail. For example, if you look at the term sheet
and we've had this conversation, the term sheet to me sort of set forth the framework of what the kind of deal was we're going to do. Well, that term sheet is not really what is moving forward, because there's more options than what was under the term sheet.
Mm-hmm.
So I get that, and I'm perfectly ready to move forward. I will also point out that, although that is a concern, I mean, I think as we go through this process, and this is our first one, you know, that if we want to go to public procurement, we ought to have at least a broad outline in the term sheet about what we want to do, what we're trying to accomplish, the range of, for example, the range of public subsidy that we expect to pay or not. I mean, it's in there, but I'm not sure it's right. You know, I'm not sure it's
mm-hmm.
– so I think that's important. I will also say, though, that the Secretary moved over this pretty quick, but the CTB – there are checks on this.
Yes.
Anybody who's putting money in this can say, I'm not putting money, including CTB.
Mm-hmm.
CTB has to allocate whatever public subsidy that comes into place. My understanding, again, failing on the law, the Secretary can't just certify it and write a check. It's got to get on the six-year plan. It's got to be allocated from transportation revenues. That's something that CTB has to do. So that's a big check for any of these that have a public expenditure. The other is the NVTA is going to have to make a decision about this. So, you know, as we're putting this deal together, they're going to be at the table, too, trying to figure out what they will or won't contribute. So there's that check as well. So this is a complicated one, but from what I see, I think we have enough to move forward, but that at least we want to hear from Charlie, but I think so.
Well, and just one piece of commentary I would offer is that at the beginning of any procurement, there's always unknown variables. So even at the most basic form of procurement with a design bid build, we don't know what the bid's actually going to be from the private sector. We do know that moving forward with that procurement for an X set of reasons may be in the public interest, either due to the simplicity of the project or other items of that nature. And so really what this finding of public interest is an expression by the commissioner based on his due diligence, meetings, and experience that he believes moving forward with some level of risk transfer under the PPCA is in the public interest. Again, the secretary is committing to come back to this committee and have further discussions as we start to quantify that, but I do think really the read and I believe the intent of the law as we worked on it with Chairman Jones and others was really to make sure that there's this discussion about what are you expecting to transfer, what do you expect to get out of that transfer, and why do you believe that's beneficial. And I think that's what the Commissioner is prepared to discuss with us today. Any other questions from members of the committee? With that, I would like to open it up to members of the audience if they'd like to address this committee, provide any comments on the type of procurement or the commissioner's finding of public interest. And I would ask that you keep your comments to 3 minutes in case there are others that want to speak and so that we can get to the business further down the agenda as well. Thank you.
Chairman,
please introduce yourself.
Nancy Smith with the Northern Virginia Transportation Alliance. First of all, I want to certainly appreciate the process that's been set up here and the due diligence and the dialogue that VDOT has gone through and that this body will go through to make this a very transparent process. I do want to say, though, that given the limited state and federal and regional resources, the Alliance remains concerned, as well as I think we can speak for much of the Northern Virginia business community, that with the state's ability, should it choose to move forward on a public financing option, the state's ability to move forward on other needed and necessary improvements, not only in the Northern Virginia region, but throughout the state, given the magnitude of the size of this project. And I think that concern was expressed well in a recent article and the WT was reported by the WTOP reporter Ari Nash, given by Marty Noe, who was chairman of the board, chairman of the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority, who expressed that while the authority certainly would be expected to be a partner on the 66 project, no matter what the financing option was put forward, that certainly on a private option, the authority would likely have to put less money up, and that the authority is watching this process very closely because they are concerned about their ability as a body to be able to fund needed improvements in the region, particularly in very congested corridors like 95 and Route 1, should a public option, which would require more authority money, be report. So just ask that you keep that in mind as you move forward in your discussions on finding a public interest on this project, of the bigger scope of the need of transportation funds in Northern Virginia. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments.
I'm Rob Whitfield, and I'm with the Fairfax County Taxpayers Alliance, and also have been involved in the past with the Committee for Dulles for over 25 years. And thank you for this meeting today. At the highest level, one of the, and I realize this is an initial meeting and an initial process, part of the concerns I have and others that here we have a meeting in Richmond. We've had other meetings with the CTB in Richmond on I-66. But ultimately, the decisions have to involve Northern Virginians. And I, in an email to Secretary Aubrey Lane, have indicated that, for instance, the CTB needs to meet in Northern Virginia at least twice a year, because it's just not acceptable for most of the decisions to be made in Richmond. And so, how you get there. So for this committee, and at some point between now and the end of the year, please come up to Northern Virginia. I've studied roads. I was a civil engineer and worked in 25 states on, actually as a geotech engineer, but doing environmental impact studies and so on. So I have somewhat of a framework of understanding when we have a project that's multifaceted, complex. At this juncture, even though you've had public hearings and Susan and, sorry, I've forgotten the other lady's name, you know, there's been many public hearings, but it seems to me that there is by no means are we near to a consensus on what is the preferred options, and I don't know how long that process will take. So, and I don't even remember now what the time frame of the outcome from the meetings that were held in June. So all of this has to be worked together with, I certainly favor, I've been to various meetings on PPTAs, and in fact, Doug Colomay presented to the Committee for Dulles in June. It was extremely helpful because most of the public does not understand some of the issues involved. And I think perhaps from that meeting in June, one of the most important questions I asked Doug was, is federal TIFIA money a potentiality if done under a PPTA as well as under the public funding process? And I think he answered yes. So we've got to work out from all the array of options which one is the most preferred. Having said that, some of the fundamental decisions to be made on the project itself are clearly not yet made. From going to the meetings, the people of Merrifield have many, many concerns, and I'm not yet, I have no knowledge of whether or not resolution is being reached. So as a final comment, I would say this. I suggested to Susan that we actually should think in terms of making the western third of the corridor as a separate project from, say, 28 or from Fairlakes westwards to Haymarket. And whether or not the need for the entire width of carriageways and the use potentially of reversible lanes is something that should be studied. But I will try and get information to you in writing, which I haven't done yet. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Whitfield. And if there are others who would like to speak after Mr. Pollard, I ask that you get up and line up behind him so that we can move forward with the agenda.
With the Southern Environmental Law Center. The proposed 66 corridor improvements are incredibly important for a number of reasons. Substantively, because of the size and scope and potential cost of the project, as well as the important first run under HB 1886 and the new process that created this committee. There are major issues both with the substance of the project, which I realize is not before you all today, as well as the procurement as it moves
Mr.
forward.
Mr. Chairman, can we turn the mic up? I'm having trouble.
Tripp, can you pull the mic a little closer?
I can lean over a little more. I can't. It doesn't get any closer. I can lean over, though.
Is that better? All right, I'll come right down here to bend over. There are clearly that the substantive issues are not before you today, but they are incredibly important, and I've heard in some of the questions here some of the frustration in what is and isn't before you. I do understand this is the process as enacted, but I do think that this points to one of the flaws with what is enacted, is I think that this body should have some ability to come back at a later date and have a greater ability to then weigh in on the merits or demerits of proceeding under a P3 for a particular proposal. Right now there are just far too many uncertainties to do more than make some very general findings. We do have significant concerns about the substance of the project, the environmental impacts, community impacts, and the like, which we have filed significant comments on the draft environmental assessment. Again, realize this isn't before you today, but I think it's important that you realize that there are enormous questions out there. Questions about also the scope and scale of the project and the need to, for example, widen all the way to Haymarket versus transit improvements and concentrating on the interchanges where the real problem lies with 66. So as for procurement, which is what's before you, we do strongly believe, as the Secretary said, it's important to keep the public financing option on the table, as well as the PPTA, that this represents, I think, some of the maturing of the PPTA process in Virginia. We've had this statute for 20 years, and it is important that we look at and consider both on an equal footing. I understand from what's been said today that that is an intent. However, there's nothing in the finding of public interest that really makes that at all clear. There's a lot of language that talks about what will happen rather than what could happen. And there's nothing in there that says that the public funding option will be considered and will be considered on an equal footing. So I would ask that you clarify that, since that is, as I understand it, the intent. And I think it would help avoid some of the confusion going forward. As you say, this is a new process. I think there already has been some confusion in the public, and making the language of this finding clear, I think, would help alleviate some of that confusion. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Stuart Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Smarter Growth. First of all, I'll note that within our Smart Growth and Transportation Reform Community, Trip Pollard's our P3 expert, so I very much endorse anything that Trip has said about this, and his review has been the most detailed of any of ours. I do appreciate the effort at public transparency that you're trying to bring to the P3 process overall, and to the extent that you can make the parameters of any deals in terms of the financing and what's going to be delivered as available as possible throughout the process, as well as the full comparison to the public option available. That will be important for the public as a whole. Obviously, we want to see the best deal for the taxpayers as well as the best transportation approach for the corridor. In this regard, we want to see a maximization of the dollars for transit. We've failed completely in the 495 and 395 corridors to really achieve a multimodal solution that adequately funded transit capacity expansion in those corridors. And certainly for this project, your justification for the project is tied intimately with the inclusion of transit with the hot lanes that you propose, and that's in your documents to the federal government in your environmental justifications for this project. So failure to achieve adequate funding and development of transit options for the corridor, whether in a P3 deal or in a public deal, I think would be a significant problem for you with this. It's in that regard that we've been very open and interested in the public option, and hope that stays on a level playing field in this discussion because of the potential to provide more funding for transit in lieu of providing a very heavy profit margin to the private companies that they receive in a P3 deal. There's been some comment about the request of the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority to support the project. We'd want to know more. We certainly would be concerned about crowding out of things like the need to fund 8-car trains and other needs in Northern Virginia, local transportation needs included. This committee should review the financing review that they just did in terms of their bond capacity and cash capacity. We'll reserve judgment on it. We certainly would like to review that as well when the time comes. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no others waiting to speak, we're going to move on in the agenda. Commissioner Kilpatrick is going to come up and give us an overview of the project and its finding of public interest. And I also wanted to note for members of the committee, we have Doug Coulmay, the director of the Virginia Office of Public-Private Partnerships, as well as Jennifer Mitchell, the director of the Department of Rail and Public Transit here, should you have questions for them as well today. Commissioner Kilpatrick.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon. What I'm going to do now is I have a presentation to walk through. I'm going to talk a little bit about the project background, the project scope, because some of you may not be as familiar with some of the general details of the project. I'm going to talk about the process we've been going through in terms of the environmental process and the outreach. I want to talk a little bit about recent work we've done regarding the project, and then talk about the finding of public interest itself, and then finish up with a path forward, and then I can answer any questions that you might have. Again, Jennifer Mitchell, our Director of Rail and Public Transportation, is here. While I am the responsible public entity for this proposed procurement, they are a significant stakeholder with the non-highway or the transit, the public transportation component. And again, they are close partners with us on this, as well as Doug Coulmay, who's the director of the Office of Public-Private Partnerships. Again, he and his staff are the ones that are responsible for acting on my behalf and during the procurement process, doing a lot of the heavy lifting. So with that, I'm going to jump right into the presentation. Again, the project that we are talking about today and the finding of public interest is for improvements to I-66 from the Beltway to Haymarket, U.S. Route 15 in Prince William County. Again, the map shows you the project. The basic design elements and design features of this project are express lanes converting the HOV lane, the current high occupancy vehicle lane, and adding one additional lane in each direction to allow for what is called HOT, H-O-T, which is high occupancy toll. So if you're three or more in the car, and that would require conversion of the HOV2 to HOV3, if you're three or more in a car, there is no toll. Less than three, you would pay a toll. So again, that's the basic concept. We would also retain three general purpose lanes in each direction, as well as what we call auxiliary lanes. And auxiliary lanes fundamentally are the connections between interchanges, on-ramps and off-ramps, to reduce weaving and some of the congestion that occurs. Another important component of this is the bus service and other multimodal improvements, higher frequency bus service, especially during peak periods, better express bus types of travel, and significant improvements in park and ride. This quarter today does not have significant park and ride facilities, unlike the 95 corridor, which is we have invested a significant amount of funds into delivering park and ride facilities along that corridor. NEPA is a National Environmental Policy Act, and what that is the environmental process that we must go through to reach for the federal government actually to reach a decision on eligibility to move forward with the project. We completed the Tier 1 Environmental Impact Statement back in 2013. We are in the process of what's called the Tier 2 of the environmental document, which would result in an environmental is an environmental assessment, which we expect will result in what's called a FONSI, or a finding of no significant impact from the federal government. We've held a number of public hearings. We look for the board to be the board of the Commonwealth Transportation Board will be briefed on a recommended location in September, and we would ask them to vote on the location in their October meeting.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question on that? Just, Mr. Rowland, in terms of the location that CTV is going to authorize in October, how's that work? Because I understand most of this is going to be within median right-of-way, existing right-of-way.
It is.
We don't know that for sure.
In terms of from a location perspective, it's largely within the existing footprint of the 66 corridor. So this, unlike some location decisions where a board may be making a decision on alternatives or on new alignment, this is frankly a pretty straightforward location process because the location is effectively the 66 corridor.
So Mr. Chairman, so it'd be okay to just say at CTV we'll probably say generally within the 66 corridor or something like that. We don't have to go
Because the reason I want to make sure the flexibility remains.
Absolutely.
For the design efficiencies, because a big part of the PPTA is going to be those that can achieve design efficiencies maybe over another rival. So I don't want to preclude that by saying, you know, you've got to stay within this lane. Or.
And Commissioner Kilpatrick, correct me if I'm wrong, but what really will be coming to the board is the preferred alternative, kind of the full bill of preferred alternative, which is really the maximum footprint and location that the preferred alternative have. We could certainly do things that are less than that.
That is correct. One of the things we ensure of in the environmental process that we evaluate the maximum footprint, the maximum possible project. We would then go in terms of at the design level of some the design level of the details of ramp configurations, of termini, of phasing of a project. All of that occurs during design phase, and in this case would occur during the procurement process. But those design level decisions are typically not brought to the board for their approval. Those decisions are done at the chief engineer level.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Mr. Fastwoods.
So when we talk about what the tasking for the private sector is to respond to the various categories are that are in the three in your finding of public interest, how is that scoped? Is it the full preferred alternative and they make the design option variations as part of their response, or are we providing the script for that?
No, I think at the time that we put out the request for qualifications, we will not have briefed the board on location and potential phasing of the project. But I think that's a reality of most large projects. We need to look at what is a reasonable segment to be building at this time. The entire scope of the preferred alternative is the full facility to Haymarket. But again, what we will be bringing to the board is a recommendation based on the information that we have and what we estimate the available funds available to the project, that the scope and scale of what we are looking at in terms of moving forward with a procurement. So for the environmental document will define that you must fit within these parameters. The procurement, the actual procurement, may be less than that, what would be considered full scope.
And Commissioner Kilpatrick, at the September board meeting, in addition to briefing the Commonwealth Transportation Board on the full preferred alternative, you'll also be discussing a phase one.
Absolutely. We will make a recommendation in terms of what we believe is a phase that is constructible, that has logical termini, that meets the purpose and intent of the project.
And so our bidders will be bidding to a specification or phase one component of the specification.
And so, Mr. Kashwitz, also at the September meeting is when the Commonwealth Transportation Board would approve going out with an RFQ. So I think really the private sector will be able to see the response of you two, as well as the other members of the CTB, and really kind of gauge looking at that phase one alternative moving forward.
So again, in terms of the environmental process, we would come to the board, brief in September. When I say the board, I'm referring to the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We will brief in September. We will request location approval in October. And then we will finish up, we'll make submission to the Federal Highway Administration for their requesting their finding of no significant impact. That takes several months. Again, looking to wrap this up in that part of it in January.
Mr. Fraley, I have another environment. If we're leaving the environmental piece, when does the Army Corps get in here? Because, well, you know why.
There's some, and I'm going to talk a little bit later on about in the risk area. But regarding the Army Corps of Engineers, they have their role primarily on a project like this is the issuance of permits under the Clean Water Act.
Right.
And that's their primary role. We don't have navigation here. We don't have some of those other things that we have in the Hampton Roads area. They are a reviewing agency during the environmental process, but in terms of permitting, that actually occurs during the design phases of the project. And we'll talk about risk in a bit here. There will be permits required from the Army Corps of Engineers for this project. Frankly, most projects in Virginia have some impact on waters of the U.S. It may be what's called a nationwide permit that's sort of programmatic, where it's almost an automatic permit with approvals. There are specific project-level permits that must be issued. Due to the nature of this project, it's widening on the existing corridor. It's improvements within the largely within the existing right-of-way of I-66. The amount and the scale and complexity of the permitting will be less complex.
And Mr. Fralin, I would just add, this is an existing developed corridor. It's very different than some of the other projects we've tried to advance previously, where we were looking at greenfield project where we had problems with flooding on the parallel facilities. I don't expect that we're going to have anything similar to some of the previous experiences we've had.
Well, you guys, I understand, Mr. Chairman, you guys are experts, but I remember the environmental impact on 81 was, back when we were in the Star Solutions days, mm-hmm. was significant, and that was an existing corridor. So I just, we need to get it straight.
In terms of public engagement and stakeholder coordination, this project, we collectively have put a significant amount of effort into getting out in the community early and often. That's a bit challenging because the information early on is not real solid in terms of we don't have design level details, but it's our best effort to try and inform people early in the process. So this is just a listing of some of the events and the places where we've had public outreach. This will continue throughout the process. There'll ultimately be design public hearings, but those won't occur until after a contract is executed and we're into the design phases. But one of the things that we've done early is to look at reducing the footprint and especially reducing the impact in terms of taking houses along the 66 corridor. That's a real challenge when you're in a built-up area like this. We've made a lot of effort to reduce that. Also working on, there have been questions, everything from sound walls to location of stormwater facilities. But this just gives you a little bit of a highlight of the meetings that we've been having to date. So back in May, Secretary Lane came to the board and briefed the board on this project and really talked about the procurement options. And it really, I'm just showing it here in two fundamental ways. One is a public-private partnership. They're known by different names, but it's basically a revenue risk concession where a tolling operator would be responsible for securing the debt, providing equity, and maintaining, operating the facility, and being responsible for any shortfall in revenue collections. So that's what the public-private partnership column really talks about. The public finance option is one where the Commonwealth of Virginia would be responsible for obtaining the funding and any debt and equity that would go towards the project. So fundamentally, this was taking this look at these two options really gave us a great view on what our possibilities might be. Now, as a result of this meeting and the discussions with the board, we reached out to the P3 concession community and wanted to get a better idea from that community as to the level of interest and how serious these teams were in terms of coming forward with a full toll revenue risk concession. So we had these meetings this summer, and I've listed there some of the primary members of the five teams that we met with. And four of the five teams, I sent a letter to them and asked for them to concur that they could materially meet the draft business terms that we provided to them. Now, you have copies of the draft term sheet, and you should also have copies of the response letters from the teams. So, again, in terms of feedback, we saw that there was clear interest and belief that they could deliver this project as a revenue risk concession moving forward.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask one question on the term sheet?
Mr. Fralin.
So, if I understand right, the term sheet as originally issued is still the valid term sheet for a full concession PPTA.
what we haven't really set forth is the design, build, operate model and what we're looking for in that, if you choose to go that proposal.
So
is that incorrect? Probably.
Let me just tell you what the term sheet does, and we can maybe free the discussion that way. So what this term sheet, and again, copies are in the back should the audience want to look at this as we discuss it, this term sheet shows you the assumptions that were used to develop those draft public finance options. So this tells you, you know, it determined here, I believe, is something of 40 years and other things of that nature.
Right.
If we were to publicly finance it, we are confident that we could likely meet this term sheet. And we've run multiple scenarios, including sensitivity analysis, that demonstrate that the public sector financing this deal can meet these terms. I think the thing the Commissioner, Director Mitchell, Director Coulmay, and myself discussed with a lot of these teams when we met several months ago was, can you deliver materially similar benefits? So again, that does not mean everything in a full toll concession where all three risks are transferred, again, construction, O&M, and revenue risk along with financing, but it means you can provide benefits that are similar. So an example of how something could be different but similar is they may say, well, we can do this with a 50-year term. For a lot of P3 toll concessions, a longer term is more advantageous than a shorter term, and they prefer terms of 45 and 50 years. They may be able to do this with that term, but in that instance, because there'd be 5 to 10 years of additional revenue, what we would look to for the teams then is for that additional corridor improvement payments to increase from that $350 million in net present value over the life of the agreement. So there are ways where folks can provide materially similar benefits that are not identical to what is laid out in this term sheet. And I think the other thing I would add on is the toll concession is the only one of the three P3 options that are contained in the commissioner's finding where revenue risk and financing responsibility is transferred to the private sector. So many of the terms in here that would deal with the financial aspects, if we were to move forward with a design, build, operate, maintain, or design, build, alternative technical concept, we would use the public finance terms from the sheet because we would be publicly financing the project. We would just be transferring to operations and maintenance and design and construction risk and not the financing risk.
Well, I just want to make sure. I'm not sure I have to understand it, but the market has to understand it. Are they clear on that? Because in my world, you get a term sheet, you respond to it. You don't. If you're not responsive to the term sheet, if you go 50 years instead of 40 years, you're not responsive. That's not what we asked for. You know what I'm saying?
And Mr. Fraylin, I think the way the PPTA has worked historically is we have put it out there and you put some broad parameters in there and then you allow the private sector to come in with different variations of that and then those are evaluated for a best value type of concept. So I think the private sector is comfortable with that. I do think there are many, when we met with them, one of their questions was, you do have flexibility in this, correct? And we answered very firmly, yes, there is flexibility. However, we need to see materially similar benefits even though they may be different in term or nature.
Right, thank you.
Mr. Caspers?
Well, I've got some questions on the three alternatives we've been bidding. This may or may not be the time to address this.
I believe Mr. Kilpatrick will be getting into
those
more.
I think I'm one slide away.
Okay, good.
I'm really close. All right, so some of the things that we've done in terms of additional due diligence since those meetings, and actually some of this has occurred before, but really some focus over the last 60 days, that we continue to meet with industry experts and people with experience in other states. We are fortunate that we have a number of folks in the consulting community that have worked both nationally and internationally and can provide us sort of the good and the bad as it's occurred in other states. The other thing that we've done is be able to meet with other state transportation agencies that have had these experiences. There's only a handful of states in the U.S. that are actively in the P3 world, ourselves, Florida, Texas, North Carolina has just begun doing some of this work, Georgia has done some work, and a few other places around the country. Canada does some of this work for both highways and other facilities. But we've really been able to pull in a lot of information and intel and insight as we work through this process. Virginia is a leader in public-private partnerships, and part of that process is us continuing to learn and evolve and learn from what the good and the bad from other places. So some takeaways here. the importance of alternative technical concepts, and that may be the first time you've heard that term, so I'll talk for just a second about that. What alternative technical concepts, you may have heard of value engineering before, and that's where a contractor or consultant team comes up with a different idea that can be used to reduce costs, improve efficiencies, improve reliability on a particular project. Alternative technical concepts in a P3 environment, what that allows individual teams to come up with good ideas, present them to the owner during the procurement process. This is a fundamental difference. For us, value engineering occurs with the winning bidder. So we have a winning bidder, they come in and they have an idea, and there's a value engineering process that's been established for a number of years. But that's only with the bidder that we have, the team we have contracted with, whether it's on design bid build, design build, or in this world. But alternative technical concepts, it's interesting talking with other states, they see great value in alternative technical concepts where teams will come up with ideas that can bring value to the project, and they hold them as proprietary. So again, it gives them advantages in submitting their bid package. What's important also about this, it isn't simply, you don't need this, you start taking things off of a project. If you didn't make me do this, I could. That's not value engineering, and that's not an alternative technical concept. Doing less work, unless less work really truly adds value. So again, this is an important concept here. The second is the importance of maintaining competition. Now in Virginia, we've had projects that have been competitive up until the signing of the comprehensive agreements. We've also had projects where we selected a single bidder or only had a single bidder, and we entered into it was a negotiated deal, or we entered into an interim agreement. So again, reinforcing that competition is a good thing throughout the process. And then the third is that the P3 teams are highly creative and adaptable in responding to these project opportunities. This project, in big numbers, is approximately $2 billion. And so it's a big project, a long corridor. There's a lot of opportunities and a lot of creativity that these teams can bring, these design build teams and these concession teams.
Mr. Pittard?
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Commissioner Kilpatrick, you had mentioned just a moment ago that four of the five teams responded in the affirmative. Is that? We kind of got sidetracked after you said that.
Yeah, we actually received responses from five teams. Four of them responded outright that they believed they could meet the terms, materially similar terms. One team had responded, but they had some additional reservations and concerns about the project. It's one of that, and that again is in your package.
Siobhan?
Yeah, just a quick question. A lot of terms I'm hearing, don't fully understand.
And I apologize, I live these every day.
I love it. The alternative technical concept. Okay, I remember in the Secretary's presentation, that was a term he used as well, that was unique only to the P3, not in the public procurement, even under design build, correct?
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, when I read your term sheet here, you have design build contract, but it does not mention. Is that just assumed that under the design build they can employ those alternatives?
Within the PPTA framework, under the Procurement Act, which is where design build is found, that authority, that ability to do alternative technical concepts is not prescribed.
Right.
Because of the flexibility of the Public-Private Transportation Act, the alternative technical concepts can be done as part of a design build P3.
So it's assumed in that. Well,
that is correct, okay. Mr. Ron.
Yes, sir.
That's it. Just want to make sure.
So now I'm going to get to the meat. Oh, no?
Question on alternative technical concepts. I don't want to overgeneralize. but it would seem that the development of the alternative technical concepts directly relate to project delivery cost, project operation cost, and perhaps project maintenance cost. I mean, is there a high correspondence between those?
Yeah, I think that there's examples around the country where in a full revenue risk concession, where concessionaires come in and said, I'll add a several hundred million dollar project that you had as a, it was sort of outside that you wanted to do, but you didn't think you have the money, because I think it can drive more revenue to the project. And that was just an example that was given where you actually received a larger, you received more improvements in terms of highway capacity for the same cost, because, again, in this particular, it was a revenue risk concession, believed that it would drive more revenue to the project. But you'll also see them in areas of maintenance. You'll see them in areas of how the facility is operated. They may come up with a different operating methodology than we've been used to. These will be all electronic toll facilities. So they may have a new insight on a new technique of how to do that, how to collect revenue. Again, it could be things where we look at a particular interchange configuration. They come back and say, well, if I move this ramp and this ramp, I can provide you better value. It's less cost. It's less impact. It's those types of discussions. But if they're not done in a proprietary way, in a confidential way, as they're trying to put their bids together, then essentially they lose any competitive advantage.
And so, Mr. Cass, was just adding on what Commissioner Kilpatrick has said, I think it can be a mix of things that reduce costs,
sure,
as well as things that can allow you to do additional improvements for the same amount of upfront public investment. So it can be a range,
sure,
of options, and it really kind of depends on the facility as to what options might be there. On 66, I imagine it could be things that allow for maybe an additional interchange where they believe there's revenue generation that's worth it.
That'd be a scope addition.
Somewhere else. Yeah, but a scope addition with the same, you know, project or public investment kind of caps and other things that have been outlined.
Okay.
Or it could be an example where they may say a slip ramp may work better here than a flyover, and that can save X millions of dollars in the construction.
Well, I'm now going to talk about my finding of public interest, which you have. And this is where I have come forward with, at this time, it's my belief that there are three P3 options that are in the public interest. And in order to better understand which project we should ultimately, or which type of project we should ultimately deliver, it's difficult to get those answers without entering into the procurement process. And so that is what I've done in terms of this finding of public interest. But I've said, in terms of the spectrum, what's called the DBFOM, Design, Build, Finance, Operate, Maintain. So you're going to hear those acronyms over and over again. But that is a full revenue risk concession. I'll say that's at one end of the spectrum where the risks are largely put to the private entity, and they're responsible for building it, designing it, building it, financing it, operating it, and maintaining it. The second is a design, build, operate, maintain. And both the second and the third option are options where the public would finance the project. The revenue collection would come back to the public for paying of debt service. The first example, the design, build, operate, maintain, is we will enter into contract with someone that will design it, they will build it, they will operate it for the period of concession. And when I say operate, it's operating the tolling facilities. And then maintenance is a combination of things like potholes and patching and mowing grass, as well as any longer-term replacement, including striping or even pavement and bridge repairs, depending on the length of concession. And then finally is a design build, where the contractor would design and build the facility. We would be responsible under separate contracting methods to operate and maintain it, and we would also be responsible for the financing. So what I've said in my finding of public interest, that the development and operation pursuant to the PPTA under these three options versus the Public Procurement Act can provide the following benefits, and I'm not going to reread them. They're there for you to view. But if I go to this next slide, this helps talk about the risk and about the risk allocation on a project. And again, in terms of where you see from a toll concession on the left to a design build with alternative technical concepts on the right, you can see where the risks fall. In all three, the design and construction risk is largely with the private entity. In our design build world, we apply most of that risk applies to the construction risk, and the design risk is stays with the contractor. They give us a fixed price, and if costs go up or costs go down, it's their responsibility. Where you're beginning to see this continuum is in operations and maintenance. Again, if the concessionaire is responsible for operations and maintenance, it would typically be a fixed fee that we would be paying them to maintain and operate, and if it costs more, they have to cover that cost within their own resources. And then finally, the financing and revenue. In a toll concession, the risk of obtaining financing and the risk of receiving sufficient toll revenue to cover the financing lays with the concessionaire. The other end of the spectrum, or the other two options under a design build, operate, maintain, or a design build with alternative technical concepts, the risk of financing and toll revenue stays with the public. Now, we talk about the risk, is it a low, medium, or high risk project? Again, the focus here, Mr. Donahue talked some about some previous examples. I'll give you a couple of examples of what I would consider high risk. Where we have reliance on outside agencies, Army Corps of Engineers, for wetland permits, and you see that especially on greenfield projects. Could be the U.S. Coast Guard in terms of a bridge, a navigable waterway in terms of clearance. It could be an area that traverses a national park, within the boundaries of a national park. So things that are completely, that are not under the control of the Commonwealth, and those are some examples where you have the federal government has the ultimate decision making. So that's an example, kind of on the permitting and ability to put the project out. In terms of design and constructability, a tunnel, a complex bridge, those things tend to have much higher risk in terms of things that can go wrong during the construction phase. You think about, a submerged tube tunnel, even though we have built, we're in our ninth tube now in Hanson Roads, that is a highly complex and difficult process. So that tends to have a higher risk. The other element of that in terms of risk is the transfer of tolling and revenue risk. And so I talked a little bit about that continuum. Now, the P3 office is part of this process. We do conduct initial risk assessment workshops. They have been in the process last week, actually, evaluating the risk in a supplementary workshop. They still have additional work to do based on this finding of public interest to bring that all together and begin to better categorize the risk profile. But at this point, in terms of the overall risk profile, I would consider this what I would say is a medium risk project. It is not, while it's a big project and it's in a high traffic area, frankly, we know how to do this. The Commonwealth has built the interstate highway, and we've widened interstate highways throughout Virginia. We are comfortable with the type of construction needed and the complexities here in terms of being able to deliver the construction itself. While there are permits required, this project will fit almost entirely within the existing right-of-way of 66, other than some, I'll call it, smaller right-of-way impacts for things like sound walls and stormwater management and some of those types of things, and then the commuter parking facilities. So we're working to locate those commuter parking facilities in areas where permitting is not will not be problematic. Because frankly, if there's a spot where we believe a commuter lot should go, but it's difficult to permit, we'll simply move the commuter lot to another area that is more easily permittable. So again, that's how we've looked at the risk on this project. And again, the other safeguards that are built into a project like this is that moving forward, regardless of the procurement method, limiting the amount of public dollars that are spent on this project before all permits are in place. And I think that's a very important piece as we look at it, whether it's a design build where it's publicly financed and it's public debt, making sure that the work that's being done and the monies that are being spent are limited to only what's necessary to develop the project through the permit and not to advance the funding beyond that. And on a full revenue risk concession where the risk falls more to the concessionaire, to again limit the amount of funds that are paid out by the Commonwealth until all those permits are in place. So those are some of the safeguards that get built into this process that we just think are absolutely critical. Because again, if we get too far into this and we can't get a permit, we want to make sure that we have not expended the public dollars.
Mr. Kashwitz?
Mr.
Franklin.
Oh, okay. There's one thing missing from your finding here versus what's on the slide, and that's the public entity under a toll concession says public contribution. And my question on the public contribution, is it too early to be able to determine whether that, and I'm asking this, I think probably some of both of y'all's legislative people will be interested in this, because are we talking about bond public, are we going to borrow the public contribution piece of this, or are we going to write a check for it, or are all those on the table right now? Where are we on that piece?
So Mr. Franklin, I think there's two components of all of this. So as the commissioner talked about earlier, back in May, the secretary did brief the Commonwealth Transportation Board on analysis that was done by several different financial entities, both on what a just baseline P3 procurement. And I say baseline because I want to note that there's always individual factors that are driving a private company as they make their decisions. And as the government, we can't take those into account. We can't quantify them. We don't know what they are. And we also looked at what it would cost us and what we could borrow and what we would need with backed by tolls and what we would need to provide up front for a public subsidy. And I think what that analysis really showed is that around $600 million, I think, is what you would see be the logical cap for a public sector upfront contribution, which would be pay-as-you-go funding. I think a lot of discussions have to happen with regard to does all that come from the Commonwealth or are there other funding partners that contribute across the Commonwealth? But I think the Secretary and the Commissioner have indicated that regardless of the type of procurement, that $600 million needs to generally be the cap period, regardless of what type of procurement we move forward with. And again, our analysis showed that we would need an additional $300 to $400 million under a public-private partnership toll concession. But again, we've had discussions with some of those parties, and they've indicated that they believe they can do it for $600 million or less, and that's something we're hoping to see from them in black and white in the coming months. And so I think $600 million would be the upfront public contribution on a pay-as-you-go basis, regardless of whether this is a P3 project under a toll concession or the other two options there, or whether or not it's a pure public finance design build outside of the PPTA process.
I've raised some questions down there.
Yeah. Let me just a couple of follow-ups. I actually was writing that down under the right-of-way. You had indicated this could all be built within the right-of-way. Is that considered part of that public contribution? I mean, there's got to be a value. If you couldn't do it without the right-of-way, and you hold the right-of-way, you hold one of the most valuable things to make this project work.
Mr. Vaughn, the right-of-way valuation was not included as a cost under the PPTA, because even under the development of a public-private partnership, the Commonwealth retains ownership of the improvements that are made, as well as any land that might be purchased during that period of time, and so there was no valuation given to that under the P3 model, either as a credit or a debit to the overall project cost.
Can I follow up with one more question? So is this project programmed in the six-year plan, and is there funding allocated for this at this point in time?
Ms. Haley raises a really good question. Currently, there are project development funds that are provided in the six-year improvement program for this project. Working with the General Assembly, though, we have made significant changes to the transportation programming process that take effect in this upcoming cycle. And so currently there is approximately $1.2 billion in the six-year improvement program that is unprogrammed to projects. We are currently soliciting applications from local government and regional entities for projects they would like to have evaluated under the statewide prioritization process, colloquially known as House Bill 2. We say it way too much in this room here. And we'll be evaluating those projects over the fall and publishing a list of scores in early January. I expect this project will be one of those projects at that time. And then the board, as it develops a six-year program next spring, will need to consider all the projects and the scores, as well as the funding that they have available as they consider which project to program. But the short answer to your question is no, it currently does not have funding, but nor do any projects that would really start in the FY17 time period and move forward.
Does the Commonwealth have experience with each of these three models that you lay out here?
The toll concession, let me get a couple of examples. 95 Express, 495 Express are full revenue risk toll concessions that are both in operation. There are some other examples that look a bit different. The Greenway was through a different procurement method. 895 is another example where all of the risk has been transferred to the operator. The downtown Midtown Tunnel, which is still under construction, is also in that. Design build at the other end of the spectrum with alternative technical concepts. The fundamental difference is we do design builds. It's a sort of a regular part of our portfolio today, especially on larger and more complex projects. The difference here is these alternative technical concepts will be able to be done. All of the teams, as part of their putting their bid together, will be able to sit down privately with us and say, well, we have a proposal here, and we would either we would either agree or reject it, and then they could build that into their bid. In the center, in terms of combining design, build, operate, and maintain, again, I'll go back to the full concession models that have existed in Virginia with the Greenway, 895, the two express projects, 95 and 495, and then the downtown Midtown Tunnel. The difference is in terms of the revenue, both in terms of the financing and the revenue is a fundamental difference. Revenue is still collected under this. It's just the money comes to the Commonwealth, and then we're responsible for disbursement to debt service and to the other programs. So we absolutely have experience throughout the spectrum. And again, building large, complex projects in Virginia, we've done it under this whole spectrum. In terms of operations and maintenance, I just don't have the resources to do it with state forces. So in any of these scenarios, I see the operations and maintenance of this facility to be contracted. And there are some real advantages to contracting it sort of in a bundled way. You do get some economies and some responsibility, especially when you link the design and construction piece with the operate and maintain. We do believe that you can get some efficiency there.
And, Ms. Daly, I would just add to the Commissioner's point, under all the toll concessions that we've done, we have done a design, build, operate, and maintain, and so we have experience valuing the operations and maintenance transfer to the private sector. It's just in those we also transferred the financing revenue, and so we do have significant experience here. Mr. Fraylin?
I'm sorry.
I should cover questions.
Go ahead.
in the discussion of risk, I understand there's different categories of risk. Are your assessments ultimately monetized so that they can be compared on a cost basis when we look at these models? Or are they qualitative in that analysis?
It's a little bit of both. but in terms of sometimes the risk, it's difficult to put a you can assign a dollar value to a risk, but whether or not that's a I'll call it is it a realistic measure? You're just you can do it when you're comparing to, but is it really what have you really transferred that amount of money? I think that's a little less clear. But again, in terms of what we're looking at risk transfer, a lot of it is qualitative, and it's a judgment in terms of you get down to at what point is transferring operations and maintenance risk. You know, because what you're having to evaluate, you're having to say, well, okay, is maintenance what we think it is? Is it going to be more or less? And then you're trying to take some parameters there to establish what it is. And then you just say, well, gosh, the potential impact of, I'll use maintenance as an example. We might establish that it's over the concession, over the life of the concession, 40 years. We think it could be $20 or $30 million in net present value. At the same time, we could realize efficiencies, and it would ultimately cost us $20-30 million less. So that's kind of the challenge in terms of when they do a value for money analysis and this risk analysis. They do establish dollar values on some of these risks, but again, in the end, you're making some fairly broad assumptions. Take revenue as an example. How much of a haircut in revenue is, how much of a haircut do you need to take? Well, if you have backstops for your revenue coming in at less than you're anticipating, maybe you don't need to take as much of a reduction if you've got good solid backstops for that. So that's just some of the examples. It becomes, you do apply money, but at the end of the day, you're still having to look at it and take some qualitative review of risk.
And Mr. Casper, the thing I would just add to what the commissioner has said is, I mean, some of these things are really trying to predict the future.
I understand.
And so really the qualitative aspects the commissioner is referencing is how you choose to predict the future. We can put quantitative figures on it after you make certain informed assumptions, but, you know, like one of the biggest items would be revenue risk. And if it says, you know, the toll revenue is going to be $1 billion in net present value over the term of the deal, at some point you need to make some assumption about what is the likelihood you may be off from that. And I think we're going to base any decisions we make on, you know, experience and fact we've seen in other facilities across both the Commonwealth and the country. But really, that is a qualitative assessment that's then monetized and made quantitative. Is what the commissioner, I think, was trying to.
And that's applied to the model by commissioner? Who makes that call?
That would be done by the responsible public entity in cooperation with the Virginia Office of Public-Private Partnerships.
And Director Coulomb's staff, that's one of the things they helped me with in this process is doing a more detailed analysis and the value, both on the risk but also the value for money analysis that they do.
Another question on the three options that I see in the finding. Are they hierarchical in a reverse direction? For instance, does the toll revenue concession model include the second and the third? I'm assuming they would have advanced technical concepts in the proposal if they did a full-blown.
Yes. So that's a good point. And another way of describing the toll concession is a DBO, design, build, operate, finance, maintain. So five letters. You get rid of finance, you're down to four letters. You get rid of operations and maintenance, you're down to design build. So the toll concession is all five.
It was most the least.
That's correct.
Okay. And Mr. Kashwitz, if you take a look at page two of the finding, you'll really see there's three categories of, you know, risk that you can put in.
Yeah.
And that's really the toll concession, you transfer all three. The design build, operate, maintain, you transfer two. And the design build ATC, you just transfer one of those.
Yeah, but two questions regarding that hierarchy of options then. Are we asking those who may bid the full concession model to give us their proposal in severable components so that we could choose any one of these three options in accepting their proposal? And I ask that because we may find that one of the full concession proposals has the best advanced technical concepts or, prevails for other reasons, but we don't want to go to the full full model for financial reasons.
And Commissioner Kilpatrick, could you go to the next slide with the schedule? Because I think that gets into some of these issues here. So a lot of the questions you're asking, Mr. Kasper, will be fully laid out in the request for proposals, or qualifications, excuse me, that will be put out in September should this, again, committee affirm the commissioner's findings, should the CTB vote in the affirmative there. But I would also say any proposer has the right to put in a proposal under any three of those options.
But do we ask for the right to select any of the three from...
So let me, because I want to make sure I answer your question, and maybe I can answer it in a little bit in this framework. You're meeting today. You are the P3 Advisory Committee, and so you're meeting today. If you vote to affirm my finding of public interest, we believe it'll take at least a week, maybe a bit longer, to put out a request for qualification. That's what an RFQ means. What we would look to do is put out a request for qualifications and say, if you have formed a team or are forming a team that believe you can deliver under one of these three options or all three of these options, you may get teams that say, I am only interested in a design, build, operate, maintain. My business model, I'm not interested in a revenue risk concession. And in big terms, some of the large American construction companies, the really big ones, they tend to not be as active in the concession world. It's not wholesale, but again, in terms of sort of how large United States construction companies have grown up, they see a bit of a different model. Some of the other large international construction companies are more familiar or more comfortable in a concession model. So you may have a team that says, well, I'm interested in my team will submit under any one of these three categories, or they will set their teams up in a way that if the financing piece is or is not a part of that, they still have a solid team. So this request for qualifications will say, teams, form, we were going to give you a package of information we expect from you to show that you're qualified to do this type of work. And this process is going to be a bit longer than we would normally do. Under just a straightforward qualification, it could be done in 30 days. But we are looking for more substantial information as part of this and to gain more clarity regarding the concession, especially the concession model. We'll also look for these teams to get some sense to what level they believe their alternative technical concepts and also the synergies of bringing operations and maintenance in together. So that is what this RFQ will do, is go out not to, just to the teams that responded, but to any team that wants to form that can come in and submit a request for qualification. It's going to be based on the draft term sheet. We're continuing to work on, I'll call it fine-tuning that draft term sheet to make sure that we're very clear on our expectations. And that will occur up and through the fall of this year. And that by the end of this year, we would look to make that determination as to the path forward. And then out of that pool of contractors or concession teams, we would either shortlist or select that group that said, if we picked a particular option, we pick option Z. I'm not going to tell you A, B, or C. So you pick option Z is the process we go. Anyone that says we can do option Z and they're in that group, then we would look to make sure they're qualified. And then depending on the number, we may shortlist down to a lesser number. If there's a dozen teams, it's unmanageable to go forward with that many teams, and we would shortlist. If there were three, four, maybe even five teams, we may take all those teams, and they're all qualified, we may take them all forward. But that's how we would take a look at, as we're gaining more information and more insight, through the next 90, 120 days to be able to make a much better decision saying, okay, we see now, we have more clarity, this is the path that we should pursue. So the other things about this, and I'll circle back, but does that help to answer that?
Well, I guess the part I'm still not clear is where the team's application of advanced technical concepts comes into this process. Is it the RFQ, or is it the RFP that follows?
The real meat of it would happen once a group of teams were selected and you get into the request for proposals. A request for qualification says, okay, teams, submit to see if you're qualified to bid and provide some basic information on your ability to finance and what the financing would be or your ability to deliver alternative technical concepts. But the real details of alternative technical concepts will happen during the request for proposal stage. And that's where you'll see the opportunities. But all three of these options have alternative technical concepts. So that's embedded.
Commissioner, I think the question Mr. Kashwitz is driving at is he's nervous that someone may be in a bucket that we may not pick, may come up with the best alternative technical concept. And if I recall correctly, the way we're structuring this construct is we would be paying some of the teams for on a revenue sharing basis for a portion of their costs, which means at the end of the day, the Commonwealth would own those ATCs should we choose to implement them post close.
That's an excellent point. One of the things that we've done both in design and some design builds and even under other P3s is we pay what's called a stipend, and if they accept the stipend, it helps offset their costs. If they submit a qualifying bid and they're not selected, then a stipend is paid. But any information that they have provided to us, we own now. And so if there's a particular idea that we really like, we basically have bought that idea by paying the stipend. And it's a pretty good technique to use where the firms that, again, it doesn't fully offset their costs of submitting a bid, but it does defray some, but the benefit to us is we get to own whatever they've provided us. They will not provide a final detail, fully designed alternative technical concept, but they might say, well, instead of putting the commuter lot here, if you move it over here, then you're going to catch all this traffic and you're going to reduce the congestion in this area and I'll reduce your costs and you may generate some revenue. Just an example, we may say, and they haven't designed the commuter lot, but we might come back and say, wow, that's a great idea. In our RFP, we're going to put the commuter lot over here. Now, this team didn't get shortlisted. They didn't make it. So we would still use that idea in our request for proposal.
And so, Mr. Kashwitz, I think the key point is the way the RFQ and the rest of the deal and the procurement will be structured is we're going to make sure we harness any of those ideas as we move throughout the process. I think one of the key things I want to draw the committee members' attention to is really just from December 2015 moving up to where we are today. If this committee, again, votes in the affirmative, what is going to happen in short order is a draft RFQ will be made available for the industry to review. The CTV will be brought before them at their September meeting. Should they, again, vote in the affirmative to move that, a formal RFQ will start the very next day. And really what we'll be doing from that point on is working with teams under any of those three buckets to gather information from them. We'll be getting more from the toll concession, a little bit less from the design build operate, and then less from the design build ATC folks. And we'll be compiling all that, and that's going to allow us to, by December of this year, make a decision about whether or not we wish to transfer that revenue risk. And again, the Secretary, when he came before you earlier today, committed to coming back to brief this committee as we move forward. I expect that we would come back to this committee in December to have a discussion saying we either are planning to transfer revenue risk along with design, construction, operations, and maintenance, and here's why, or we're not planning to transfer financing and revenue risk, and here's why. And we're only, and so I think that's that type of discussion, the commitment that the Secretary was making to this group earlier.
Clarify for my sake, then that would assume that when we go to the RFP process, we are looking for the full range of services in that RFP to be able to make that decision.
In the RFQ, we will allow all three types of proposals to be submitted.
I understand. But then in the RFP phase, where there's more detailed information, how do we get that quantified information to make the ultimate decision whether a public or a private alternative to the financing is most viable?
And so, Mr. Kasowitz, we probably will not issue a final RFP before we make the decision about whether to transfer revenue and financing risk. What we're going to do is provide information to the teams that let them put together a draft financial model and other aspects that we can then review to determine which one of these risk transfer, you know, options along the spectrum is in the best interest of the taxpayers.
I have some more questions, so I was waiting until, is it now time?
Sure.
And I want to apologize to everybody. I don't want anybody leaving this meeting thinking that this committee didn't do our due diligence and that this was a rubber stamp for anybody, because that's not what we're doing here. And Mr. Commissioner, I heard you say that the operations would likely be contracted out on 66 for toll collection outside the Beltway, but we've got, and I know we're not supposed to cross the Rubicon nor talk about inside the Beltway 66, but we're going to do operations there. I was actually glad to see that the operations was on here, thinking that if we decide to keep the operations, we could do an operations across the entire 25-mile stretch plus inside the Beltway. So help me understand that a little bit.
Mr. Franklin, what I would say is you'll be getting a briefing on that at the September Commonwealth Transportation Board meeting.
Oh, good.
And I expect we'll be able to answer all of your questions in more detail at that time. We are aware of the potential synergies.
Roger that.
A single operator for that corridor, but we'll discuss that in more detail at the September board meeting.
Okay, well, I'll withdraw the question.
And when I use the term that we would contract that out, I don't physically have employees that I can afford to divert from other tasks. I'm limited on the number of employees I have. So that would be a contracted service, whatever form that it might take.
And then an observation, then I want to ask a question, make sure my assumptions are right. I do understand there's certain, and I saw some squirming in the room when we were talking about proprietary information and issuing payments in order to capture that proprietary information, and that's going to be subject to negotiation. I don't want anybody to think that's just, I mean, I recognize, and I'm sure you guys recognize, there's a lot of cost involved on the public end, I mean, on the private end of this as well, and there's some, you know, but I don't think it would serve us well to send the message to the public that we're going to sort of mix and match whatever we want and pull out this and put it in some and give it to somebody's competitor to make their project more efficient. I think we need to make sure we're clear that that's really not what we're doing.
And Mr. Fralin, just to clear up any misconception we may have provided, as the commissioner said, the ATCs is something that happens during procurement,
right.
And the ATCs at that time stay with the individual firm that has developed them. However, should a firm that did not advance towards the end come up with an idea that the commissioner believes to be of value,
right,
after that contract is closed and executed based on the merits of that firm's proposal, we may then ask for an additional tweak to the design, as we do under the design build process today with value engineering. So no, we're not going to be picking and choosing and making, you know, the stew we like the best.
I get it. No, I just want to make sure that was the case. The second thing is, I'm going to just say this for me, but I think my colleagues on the panel will agree. One of the things that we have not seen all of the workshop risk analysis. We haven't dug through all that stuff. We haven't seen all that information. When I vote to affirm this, which I intend to do, I'm relying on you and professional VDOT staff to have certified to this committee through this letter that this is in the best interest of the Commonwealth to proceed this way. It's not a final decision that we're going to either pick any one project or that even we're going to proceed, but that in your best judgment and based on the questions that we've asked, that this is a preferred option to go ahead. And so that's where I'm coming from. So that's not a question, that's an observation.
Understood. Do any other members of the committee have questions for Commissioner?
No. Mine might be actually more directed to Janet Ehler from Treasury.
Uh-oh.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the General Assembly has to authorize all debt, all public debt, whether 90 or 90C.
Correct.
So if the P3 project that's proposed has a debt component, that would still have to come back before the General Assembly, correct?
Correct.
Well, Commissioner Kilpatrick, do you have any closing comments, or have you wrapped up?
Again, thank you very much for allowing me to present today. And again, going forward, as Deputy Secretary said, I will be back in front of you again. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Kilpatrick. Members of the committee, and Mr. Kilpatrick, if you could put the draft resolution at the back of the room so members of the public could see that as well. I did take the liberty of drafting a resolution. A resolution for this committee to consider should it choose to affirm the commissioner's finding of public interest. It has three whereas clauses. The first is essentially walking through the authority of the department to enter into a P3 procurement. The second describes the fact that this committee has in fact met and received presentations. And the third recognized that the commissioner has executed a finding of public interest that initiating the procurement, procurement for the project under the PPTA is in the public interest. There are two be it resolved clauses. The first is that through an affirmative vote of a majority of committee members that the committee concurs with the commissioner's findings pursuant to 33.2, 1803.2, and finds that the proposed development and operation of the project as a qualifying transportation facility under the PPTA serves the public interest. And be it further resolved, the committee requests a briefing from the commissioner on the project and the risk to be transferred prior to the issuance of the final request of proposals. Again, really affirming and putting into this resolution the secretary's commitment as well as the administration's to come back and brief this body further in that December time frame after we've really done more due diligence with the teams through a P3 procurement process. I just wonder if members of the committee have any comments or questions on this draft resolution or resolution. Mr. Vaughn?
Yeah, no, I appreciate, I feel a lot more comfortable with your further resolve. Because as I stated from the get-go, and it is a chicken and an egg, William, and I don't know, I like them both, but but when it comes to this, I am concerned, and I think that these findings or the comprehensive agreement or whatever just needs to be clear as it relates to the expected benefits by going this route versus the public entity, and because. I just think that if after the fact, it is not clear, and then after the fact, after that fact, it becomes clearer. And I think, we're all concerned about what took place on at 460. I know my chairman is. Mm-hmm. So I wish we had that. I don't know how we rectify it. We certainly can't do it here. It may just be something, maybe legislatively we need to tweak this a little so that we can get a better apples to apples, but I think at least the comfort of it coming back or more, if no other reason, we can all sit there and make our necessary comments at that time.
And Mr. Vaughn, I would just really reiterate the commitment of this administration, Secretary Lane, to a transparent and open process. I think the Secretary has demonstrated through numerous venues and avenues his commitment to really being held accountable for the actions that the Commonwealth Transportation Board, VDOT, and DRPT take on these projects. And I really do think he believes the input is a good thing. He likes to hear the questions. He wants to hear the concerns because ultimately, at the end of the day, that will let us make a better project and process moving forward. And so when we come back to this committee in the future, I really do expect that we'll have much more detail based on those discussions and be able to hopefully provide you with more of that information about really quantifying some of the benefits we expect to receive rather than just the description that's included in the commissioner's finding. Mr. Pitter?
I just want to confirm, Chairman, that the public finance option is still on the table until, in your time frame, I think it showed December, there would be a decision.
Mr. Pittard, to that point, I think even if in December we choose to try and transfer the financing and revenue risk, we will always try and keep the public financing option on the table to ensure that we move forward, and should the deal change or get to a point where it's no longer of interest, we always will have a backup plan available to the Commonwealth to implement this project.
I had one comment and then a... Well, one comment about that and then one comment about the pros.
We've heard a lot about this public interest. So why are we running the public interest, the thing at the same time? And the reality is the public solution is always the backup plan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if we get to the very end of this deal and we can't reach a concession agreement for whatever reason, that's still the backup plan. We still
Correct.
Have congestion on 66. We still have a problem that we got to deal with. We still have all those issues. So in some ways, that's kind of a red herring. It's a little bit of a red herring in the way that 460 is a red herring, because these guidelines, what we're doing, are different all along. And so, anyway, that just makes it obvious. The other thing is, the way I read the now therefore be it resolved, the proposed development operation of the project, is the development and operation is together like a potential.
That's
not the operation of. We're not certifying that a PPTA is the way to go. We're saying that it's worth exploring.
That is my interpretation as well, Mr. Fraley.
Right. If I can follow up on that, I mean, I would, if I were writing it, I would say under the PPTA may serve the public interest. Because you don't want to preclude this other option.
Let me grab the statute.
Yeah, I think we have.
I think we at this.
We have
maybe,
to serve
maybe you can't put it that way.
I don't think we can put it that way.
That was
in
my
this
intent as a voter that it may serve. I can't say with certainty that it does serve.
And I think the reality of the situation is, even though I think the law requires us to state it this way, this is not an execution of a contract. So there is still that may as we move forward in the procurement process. So, again, I think we need to leave the language as it is, but I think the reality of what you stated will be there. Mr. Petter?
I think, you know, to serve the public interest thing, I guess, you know, I sat through these meetings with you, Chairman, and there's a $2.1 billion cost listed in the term sheet here. We set a $600 million PAYGO amount, and we put those terms out, and we had, you know, I guess four of the five proposers have attested they can meet or exceed that. So, you know, I know the technicalities in the code section, but to me, when I talk about public interest, I would say that it is in the public interest to seek the best competition to get the best and most efficient use of public resources on this project. So I'm tending towards going ahead with the affirmation based on that.
Any other comments from members of the committee?
Move the resolution.
Do I have a second?
Second.
All right. All those in favor of approving the resolution, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Well, thank you very much, members of the committee. I appreciate you spending several hours with us here this afternoon. We will stay in communication with you all in the coming months. And, again, any future meeting, we will try and post far in advance as well so members of the audience can attend that meeting. We do believe a transparent process is the best way to get the deal that's best for the Commonwealth. So, again, thanks for coming this afternoon.
Thank you.
Over now.